and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 25th. I'm your reader, Mary Neff. Before we take a look at the top stories today, we'll look at the weather. You may have already experienced some storms where you are. There will be some early and then again late today. There's going to be a wind of about 15 to 25 miles an hour with a high of 87 and a low of 61. It's going to cool down a little bit then. We're going to have a story about that in a moment. Tomorrow it's going to be partly cloudy and breezy, high 76 and a low of 54, but those winds will be at 20 to 30 miles an hour. And then on Monday, mostly sunny, winds diminish 5 to 10 miles an hour, and that high will still be a little lower than we have had, high of 79 and a low of 57. The normal highs and lows are 82 for a high and 62 for the low, but in 1931, on this date, there was a record high of 102, and in 2004, there was a record low of 43 degrees. So far in June, we've had 2.27 inches of rain, with the normal precipitation for June being a little over 5 inches. The normal precipitation through June for the year to date is about 17.64 inches, and our total precipitation so far this year has been 11.18. And our days are starting to get just a little tiny bit shorter. Sunset tonight will be at 8:46 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 5:33. So today's daylight will be 15 hours and 14 minutes. Corey Thompson brings us this brief weather story today that's titled A Brief Cool Down Ahead. Today's weather will feel pretty warm and muggy for most, with dew points reaching into the highest category on what he calls the muggy meter. However, this will see a pretty notable shift by Sunday after a cold front moves through. We'll go from a high of 87 today, as we said, down to a low of 54 by Monday morning, or a total drop over 36 hours of about 33 degrees. This isn't the wildest shift we've seen on record in Cedar Rapids, though. That belongs to a drop between June 5th and June 7th, 1977, when temperatures fell from 95 to 49, or a drop of 46 degrees. The forecast swings the other way, back to the 90s by middle of the week, and again, that's from meteorologist Corey Thompson. Not unexpectedly, the large banner headline on the Gazette's front page reads, Justices End Abortion Rights. Now, that particular story is one that is reprinted from the Washington Post. And on that note, we will use the local stories that are more relevant to our local listeners. So there is, however, a sidebar article that is titled, Iowa Poised to Restrict Abortion Access, and written by Michaela Ram and Tom Barton of the Gazette. Dateline Cedar Rapids. Now that the U.S. Supreme Court has struck down Roe v. Wade, the landmark case that 50 years ago established the fundamental right to abortion, Iowa lawmakers are free to dramatically reduce or outlaw the procedure in the state. The reversal of the 1973 case puts the power back into the state's hands to decide the future of abortion access for its residents, meaning the rule's impact will vary state to state. According to the Guttmacher Institute, at least 26 states are certain or likely to ban abortion in the near future. In Iowa, where Republican leadership has attempted for years with some success to restrict abortion, access to the procedure is likely at risk. Iowa Republicans, including Governor Kim Reynolds, heralded the ruling and vowed to continue to protect the unborn. No restrictions went into effect in Iowa with the court ruling, and abortion remains legal in the state up until 20 weeks. Planned Parenthood clinics across Iowa and the Emma Goldman Clinic in Iowa City remain open and patient care continues. However, that's not true for other states. Trigger laws in North Dakota and South Dakota, passed in anticipation of the ruling, went into effect Friday, news reports showed. Reynolds lauded the court for upholding the enduring truth that all human beings, without exception, are created equal. Reynolds said in a statement, "By that measure, today's historic decision is clearly one such moment. But the fight for life is not over. As governor, I won't rest until every unborn Iowan is protected and respected." Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, echoed Reynolds, stating the court, quote, restored a fundamental truth Iowa Republicans have always known, life is precious. Iowa House Republicans will continue to protect the innocent lives of unborn children, Grassley said in a statement. Reynolds and legislative leaders did not respond to messages Friday as to whether they would call a special session of the Iowa legislature to take up a new abortion law. Republican leaders in the legislature previously have pushed for further abortion restrictions in Iowa. In 2020, they passed a proposal, which was signed into law, that enacted a 24-hour waiting period before obtaining an abortion. The federal ruling also follows the Iowa Supreme Court decision last week to overturn a 2018 ruling that the state's constitution had provided a fundamental right to abortion. In the 182-page ruling released June 17, Justice Edward Mansfield wrote, "The previous ruling, quote, insufficiently recognizes that future human lives are at stake," end quote. It sent the case back to a lower court for reconsideration, but the decision was a dramatic reversal of precedent in Iowa. Other Republican policymakers reacted to Friday's news, praising the federal court. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst said, "I'm proudly and adamantly pro-life. This decision reflects the science, will save lives, and rightly returns policymaking power back to the American people and their elected officials." Republican Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley echoed Ernst's statement, describing the reversal as a correction of, quote, a flawed legal analysis, writing, "This ruling does not ban the practice of abortion, but instead empowers the people, through their accountable elected representatives, to make common sense policy decisions. It takes policymaking out of the hands of unelected judges," end quote. Iowa Republican U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson of Marion said the decision, quote, will save countless lives. "In Congress, I will continue to champion pro-life policies and work to support expecting mothers and their babies," Hinson said. To abortion providers and other supporters, the decision was a serious blow to women's reproductive freedoms. In a call with reporters, Planned Parenthood North Central States President and Chief Executive Officer Sarah Stowes described the ruling as devastating and a, quote, shattering moment for women. "Politicians are now in charge of our bodies in ways that they were not yesterday," Stowe said. Planned Parenthood, Iowa's largest abortion provider, emphasized abortions are continuing in states where it remains legal to do so. Organization leaders say they are hiring more staff and funneling resources to those states in anticipation of an influx of women traveling from out of state to seek abortions. Stowe said, quote, "We've been preparing for months and months to make sure that we're able to care for patients," end quote. ACLU of Iowa Legal Director Rita Bettis Austin said, quote, "In the face of this shocking and dangerous decision, we will not give up the fight for abortion rights," end quote. Iowa Democrats vowed the fight to protect reproductive rights in Iowa is not over, stating Reynolds and Iowa Republicans will do everything in their power to outlaw abortion in our state. "Iowa Democrats will continue to fight for every Iowan's right to decide for themselves if, when, and with whom they want to have a family," Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn said Friday during a call with reporters. U.S. Representative Cindy Axne, Iowa's lone Democrat in Congress, said, "Today when I woke up, I had freedom, more than my mother had. And in the middle of the day, I now have less freedom than my mom had. This is not what America wants. America has said clearly that women's choice, women's ability to control their own health care decisions, is strictly to be between themselves, their family, and their doctor," end quote. According to the latest Gallup poll, more than 8 in 10 Americans believe abortion should be legal to some degree, and a majority did not want Roe v. Wade overturned. At the same time, the country remains far from unified on the extent to which abortion should be legal, according to Gallup. Democrats said Friday's ruling will not keep women from getting an abortion, but rather make abortions less safe for those without the means to travel to surrounding Midwestern states where abortion access has been upheld. Axne said, "So, what this will do is just hinder Americans once again from opportunity for the decision to make their own health care decisions, from their ability to build their opportunities for their families and their careers." She also pointed to a solo concurring opinion from Justice Clarence Thomas stating that the court should reconsider rulings protecting contraception, same-sex relationships, and same-sex marriage. She said this is the tip of the iceberg for the Republican Party, and it starts with taking away the right women have in this country. Also on the Gazette's front page, idea to close downtown Iowa City pool draws swimmers' ire. And this is from Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette, and it is Dateline Iowa City. As Iowa City weighs the possibility of closing the pool at the Robert A. Lee Community Recreation Center, which the city says is in need of extensive repair, residents are voicing concerns over losing a centrally located recreational opportunity. The city is in the process of reimagining recreation in Iowa City while also evaluating current conditions, lifespan, and programming of its facilities under the Gather Here Recreation Master Plan. The draft plan includes big picture ideas for the next 10 to 15 years, said Julie Seidel Johnson, the city's Parks and Recreation Director. The goal of the master plan is to shape the facilities and programs to better serve the community. The draft recommends adding a warm water fitness pool to the Mercer Park Aquatic Center pool and closing the pool at the downtown Robert A. Lee Center. It also recommends renovating the 73-year-old City Park pool to make it more accessible. The recommendations, which also include improvements to Scanlon Gymnasium and athletic fields, were put together after last year's public input events and analysis from Barry Dunn, the consulting firm working with the city. The city had a second phase of community feedback last month that included two open house events and asking residents to submit online comments. The Iowa City Council discussed the Recreation Master Plan at its work session this week. The council did not make any decisions about the plan Tuesday and will likely continue the discussion at its July 12th work session. Mayor Bruce Teague said this is a major thing to talk about. Council member John Thomas said he was very hesitant to give up the Robert A. Lee pool because of its central location, adding that the pool is open year-round. Thomas said, in my view, the idea would be to simply commit to the location and then rethink what that pool is so that we get a better match between what we're hearing in the report. Teague and Mayor Pro Tem Megan Alter both expressed wanting to get more feedback from residents before commenting on specifics. Council members also discussed the future of recreation in Iowa City. Alter said, I think we need to improve upon and create a better future for our existing facilities, first and foremost, but just be aware that even that is going to have a huge price tag. We're really going to have to consider that in a very, very realistic way. The 58-year-old pool at the Robert A. Lee Community Recreation Center is in need of extensive and expensive repair, according to the consulting firm. The cost to fully renovate the pool and locker rooms is estimated between $4.5 and $5 million. The recommendation is to add a warm water pool next to the existing Mercer Aquatic Center pool, which is in good condition, and close the pool at the rec center. Adding the warm water pool to Mercer is estimated at $8 to $9 million. Seidel Johnson said among the issues at the Lee pool are the condition of the underground pipes, filters, and pumps, everything that makes the pool run besides the water, she said, adding that its use is lower than perceived, which residents have pushed back on. Six Iowa City residents, Jill and Justin Fishbaugh, Ann Stapleton, Susan Melliker, Mark Cannon, and Karen Crane co-wrote a letter to the council earlier this month. The letter, which has nearly 160 signatures in support, expressed concerns about the potential pool closure and recommended renovating it instead. The letter highlighted the pool's central location, how the cost to add the warm water pool at Mercer is higher than renovating the rec center's pool, and how the number of lap lanes would be decreased. Nearly 20 residents shared their thoughts about the draft recommendations at Tuesday's council meeting. There were about 40 people there during public comment. Stapleton, one of the letter's authors, told the council she's been swimming at the pool for 36 years. She said it is accessible to all ages and compatible with the city goals of downtown services that promote a walkable urban community. Other residents who spoke shared their concern about the decrease in lap lanes if the pool were to close. Residents also voiced the friendships they have formed. Susan Melliker, a lifelong resident of Iowa City, said, "Iowa City has been a swimming town my whole life." Stapleton said, "I've been heartened but not surprised by widespread support for keeping Robert A. Lee Pool and renovating it." Last month, Elsa Fisher, a senior consultant with Barry Dunn, said if the Robert A. Lee Pool were to be renovated, it would be very costly. Part of the reason for the high cost, she said, is because the pool is built on top of a bomb shelter. Both during Tuesday's meeting and in the letter to council, residents raised concerns about the validity of this comment. Iowa City architect Roland Wehner, who helped design the rec center, among other city buildings, with Henry Fisk, said neither the pool nor the building is built on top of a bomb shelter. Wehner referred to the original blueprints, which are kept at the State Historical Society in Iowa City. Sidell Johnson, the city's parks director, said there is no space under the pool, but that the building had been designated a nuclear fallout shelter. Signs outside the building reading "Fallout Shelter" were taken down in 2017. Extra thick concrete also has been discovered in the building during smaller renovations, Sidell Johnson said. The city believes this is due to the fallout shelter designation. Wehner, however, told the Gazette the thick concrete was used for structural reasons. The building was not designed with the intent of it being a fallout shelter, and nothing was done specifically to meet that requirement, he said. It just happens that we had initially decided we wanted a building that could last 100 years, Wehner said. We picked structural elements and constructed components that would be lasting. And so because it was already designed as a better construction, it was then deemed it would be suitable, as many other buildings around the community, as a fallout shelter. The Iowa City Council is anticipated to continue discussing the Rec Master Plan at its next work session July 12th. Parks and Rec staff is looking for the council to confirm the priorities and strategies so staff can continue working on a final version. The Parks and Rec Commission is expected to review the final plan in August or September, and then it would come before the council, Sidell Johnson said. The plan also will be available to the public. Moving to Iowa Today, here's an article about an election result change. McClintock wins GOP Senate 42 primary by 2 votes. This is from Tom Barton. Just 2 votes still separated the candidates, but a different Republican candidate emerged victorious in a state Senate race following hand recounts this week in Linn and Benton counties. State Representative Charlie McClintock on Friday came out just 2 votes ahead of combat veteran Coleman Silbernagel in a reversal of the unofficial June 7 Republican primary election night results for Iowa Senate District 42. The district covers much of rural Linn and Benton counties. There is no incumbent senator in the district because of redistricting in 2021. McClintock will face Democrat Jessica Wiskus of Lisbon in the November 8th general election. McClintock posted on Facebook, "Now it is time for us to move forward as a united Republican team and prepare for the general election in November." McClintock thanked Silbernagel for running a professional campaign, a tremendous ground game, and service to his community and country. McClintock of Alburnett and Silbernagel of Vinton defeated Justin Wasson of Cedar Rapids, with Silbernagel in the lead June 7th with 1,514 votes out of 3,729 ballots cast, according to unofficial results. He was followed by McClintock with 1,512 votes. Following the recount, McClintock picked up 3 votes from ballots cast in Linn County initially marked as undervotes on June 7, but which a recount board, including representatives from both campaigns, determined were votes for McClintock. Another 5 recorded undervotes in Benton County were determined to be valid votes for both candidates. By Friday afternoon, after Benton County certified the recount results, McClintock was ahead with 1,518 votes to Silbernagel's 1,516, according to the Iowa Secretary of State's website. Silbernagel posted on Facebook, "The recount is finished, and unfortunately it did not go how we had hoped. That said, let me be the first to congratulate Charlie McClintock on his nomination." The candidates shared similar views on some issues, but split on a proposal to use public funds for private school scholarships. McClintock, who represents House District 95, opposed Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' school voucher bill that would divert some taxpayer funds towards scholarships for students to attend private schools, but said his future positions would be determined by his constituents' desires. Silbernagle said he would support similar bills. Continuing with the Iowa Today section, authorities identify man killed in Iowa grain silo collapse. This is from Yarmouth, Iowa. The Des Moines County Sheriff's Office on Friday identified a man killed in a grain silo collapse as a 30-year-old resident of the small southeast Iowa city of Winfield. Ricky Ryan Kammerer was killed in the collapse of a silo Tuesday morning at the Agriway grain elevators in Yarmouth. His body was recovered Wednesday afternoon. Authorities said two men had just unloaded a semi-trailer full of grain into a holding shed at the elevator when they heard a loud bang and began running from the facility as the silo partially collapsed. Nearly 60 emergency responders, contractors, and towing crew members responded to the scene to remove the debris in an effort to reach the man. Yarmouth is about 12 miles northwest of Burlington in far southeast Iowa. We have a public safety story here from Emily Anderson. Solon man charged with burglary and assault at Iowa City home. Dateline is Solon. A Solon man was arrested Thursday night on charges he tried to break into an Iowa City house and assaulted a juvenile who tried to stop him. Benjamin Harrison, age 45, faces charges of first-degree burglary, third-degree burglary, assault causing bodily injury, second-degree criminal mischief, and driving while barred. On June 16th, Harrison entered the garage of an Iowa City home around 7:30 p.m. and tried to get into the house, according to a criminal complaint. He wasn't able to get into the house, but did cut the wires to the chain drive electric garage door opener. Then, around 10:30 p.m., Harrison attempted to break into the house through the back patio and was confronted by a juvenile resident of the home. The two fought, damaging the patio door and causing a cut on the hand of the juvenile, the complaint states. The fight continued into the backyard, where Harrison allegedly choked the juvenile for 15 to 20 seconds before running away because other members of the household were calling the police. A warrant was issued for Harrison's arrest, and he was booked Thursday night after an officer recognized him while driving. Harrison's driving status was barred. And also on Iowa Today, Cedar Rapids murder defendant wants to represent himself at trial, from Trish Mahaffey, Dateline Cedar Rapids. A man accused of bludgeoning a woman with a board refused to waive his right to speedy trial Friday and asked a judge to let him be his own lawyer. Arthur J. Flowers, age 62, asked the judge to appoint a standby lawyer to assist him or replace his two lawyers with new ones who can be ready to represent him when his trial starts Tuesday. Flowers, charged with first-degree murder, said he wanted different lawyers who had experience and didn't have a large caseload so they could meet with him when he wanted, unlike the two public defenders he has now. Flowers said during the hearing, "I ain't did nothing to nobody. I'm fighting for the rest of my life." He also said he was extremely dissatisfied with his lawyers and made disparaging remarks about them. Sixth Judicial District Judge Faye Hoover explained to Flowers that because he had demanded his right to a speedy trial, the last day his trial could start would be July 12th if it didn't start Tuesday. She said new attorneys likely would need more than a few days or weeks to review his case and prepare for trial. Flowers, in a loud voice, said he wouldn't waive a speedy trial because he knew people in Illinois who had been waiting 9 years to get to trial, and he didn't want that. Hoover told him the longest he would have to wait in trial in jail would be a year if he waived a speedy trial, but he refused again. Flowers ultimately said he wanted to represent himself, but he was open to the court appointing a standby lawyer to assist him during trial. Hoover then attempted to ask him a series of questions to make sure he understood what he was charged with, the possible penalties, and if he was familiar with the criminal rules of law, procedure, and evidence. Flowers said he understood he was charged with first-degree murder, but was innocent. Hoover became stern with him because he wouldn't answer her question of whether he understood he could be sentenced to life in prison if he is convicted. Flowers, who made some disrespectful remarks to Hoover, finally said he understood, but added that if he's convicted, he will appeal in federal court. Hoover attempted to find out about Flowers' educational background, but Flowers first said he went to 6 different colleges, but could only recall one, Joliet Junior College in Joliet, Illinois, when she asked. Hoover then asked if he had completed high school, and he said he learned everything by reading books, like Abraham Lincoln. She explained that he would be held to the same standards as a lawyer during trial, and she needed to make sure he understood. Flowers said he had taken a criminal justice class in the past, and that he had defended himself 3 times on murder cases in 1978, 84, and 81. He also said he had been arrested for murder 7 times, but didn't say where those occurred. Earlier in the hearing, he said he'd been arrested 90 times, then changed it to 400. In Linn County, he has previous convictions for harassment and assault. Assistant Linn County Attorney Jordan Shire, during the hearing, asked the judge to go forward with the trial on Tuesday. Hoover said she would submit a written ruling probably over the weekend about whether she will allow Flowers to represent himself and if the trial will go forward Tuesday. Flowers called 911 on April 2nd, and when officers arrived at his home in southeast Cedar Rapids after 6 p.m., he told them a woman, later identified as Emily Leonard, age 22, of Cedar Rapids, had overdosed on heroin. According to a criminal complaint, Flowers initially attempted to leave when officers arrived, but then took them to a bathroom, where they found Leonard with obvious head injuries and blood spatter all over the bathroom. The woman's clothing was in disarray, and police found a bloodied 1x6-inch board, which investigators believed was the murder weapon based on the woman's head injuries, the complaint stated. Investigators say they found blood evidence in another area of the home, where Leonard was likely killed and then her body moved. During an interview with police, Flowers said he was alone with Leonard, a person he had known for many years, from Friday through Saturday, when he called 911, according to the complaint. Flowers provided details about the incident that were not consistent with the crime scene, police said. He also appeared to have blood on his hands and was wearing what he described as Leonard's pants when officers arrived, the complaint stated. Moving to the Insight page, the Gazette's editorial today is titled, Stop Attacking Public Libraries. Public libraries play many roles. They are, of course, a repository for a diverse set of books and other materials that can be accessed by patrons. They're also a community center, a place to access technology, a site for providing services, a venue for meetings and gatherings, and more. Unfortunately, here in Iowa, they've also become a political flashpoint. The Gazette's Gage Miskimen reported this week on the sad saga at the Vinton Public Library, where 2 directors have resigned in the past 2 years amid complaints about a, quote, liberal agenda. The library has some LGBTQ books in its children's section, but not enough religion-themed works, according to critics, and has hired LGBTQ staff members. The library also displayed children's books by First Lady Jill Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, but not enough Donald Trump books. Some library patrons checked out books they see as objectionable and failed to return them. It's worth noting that the library also has the support of local residents. The library board responded to these criticisms by approving an ethics policy that says the board will respect the decisions of professional staff and will not be swayed by public pressure. It's the right call. And Vinton is hardly alone. Other public and school libraries across the state have faced similar criticism over LGBTQ-themed books and other issues. These calls for books to be removed are coming mainly from the political right, from people who see agendas and conspiracies among the library stacks. Of course, these views are being fed by opportunistic Republican politicians who see a sinister agenda in making certain materials they've dubbed obscene or pornographic available in libraries. Some even talked of creating criminal charges for teachers and school staff who made, quote, obscene books available to students. These books are not obscene by any reasonable or constitutional definition, and the only agenda being followed is the core mission of public libraries, which includes providing free access to books and other materials for all members of the community. Trained staff use their professional judgment to make sure collections reflect the needs of patrons and to guard artistic freedom from government interference and political pressure from the loudest critics. Instead of second-guessing and heaping politically motivated derision on libraries, we should be valuing them as a unique and important public institution. If that doesn't make sense, there's probably a book that can explain it. Check it out, and that's the Gazette's editorial today. Lauren Behrens of Cedar Rapids has submitted this community letter, and it is titled Praise for the Gazette's series of Title IX articles. Kudos to the Gazette for the series of articles leading up to the 50th anniversary of Title IX. I've been pleased to see them right where they belong, on the front page of the sports section, usually above the fold. Readers may not realize how unusual it is to see regular and substantive newspaper and TV coverage of girls' and women's sports, because our local news outlets do a much better job of it than national averages. Research from Purdue University and the University of Southern California reports only a little more than 5% of sports coverage nationwide is about women and girls, with virtually no growth in the past 30 years. Take out women's soccer, and the percentage of coverage drops below 3%. Contrast this abysmal record to dramatic growth in girls' participation. When Title IX came into effect 50 years ago, about 1 in 27 school-aged girls went out for sports. In 2019, it was 1 in 3, catching up to boys' participation at a rate of about 4 in 10. Make no mistake, there still is room to grow toward parity in programs for and media coverage of sports for women and girls, but the Gazette is to be commended for working toward that growth by making a big deal out of the 50th anniversary of Title IX in sports. Now, how about more coverage of all the difference Title IX has made beyond the world of sport? And again, that is from Lauren Behrens of Cedar Rapids. We want to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 25th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. I must say, in the, I think it's 5 or 6 years that I've been doing radio reading, this is the fewest number of obituaries I think I've ever seen. We have 2 short notices. One from Grand Mound, Leland S. Rugeberg, Rugeberg, age 84, died Thursday, June 23rd. Arrangements are being made through Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. And from Postville, Amelia Marie Schley, age 91, died Thursday, June 23rd. Those arrangements are being handled through Schutgrau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Postville. Moving to the longer notices, there is one that is longer and then one that is very short, and I never have a chance to do this. So today, because there are so few obituaries, I'm going to have the opportunity to read to you a full obituary with all the history and things that we sometimes have to edit for the interest of time. Merlin B. Kruckenberg, age 94, of Loudoun, passed away Thursday, June 23rd, at the Clarence Nursing Home. Funeral services will be held Monday, June 27th at 3 p.m. at Trinity Lutheran Church. Burial will follow with military honors in Trinity Lutheran Cemetery, and visitation will be at the church from 2 p.m. until service time. Merlin was born in 1927 in Loudoun, the oldest of 7 children. He was baptized on August 21st and confirmed at Trinity Lutheran on April 6th of 1941, where he was a lifelong member and served on various boards. He was a treasurer on the board of directors for the formation and building of the Lutheran camp, I hope I say this right, Iodisica, near Solon. He also served as a district president of the International Water League and as an agent and president of Wheatland Mutual Insurance Company. He attended Trinity Lutheran for 8 years and graduated from Loudoun High School in 1945, then farmed with his brother Robert until moving to a new home in Loudoun in late 2014. He enjoyed traveling and taking pictures. took several trips to Europe. In 1951, during the Korean War, he served for 2 years and was attached to a Norwegian hospital unit near the battlefront of some of the most intense fighting of the war. He was a lifetime member of Lillis Dierberg American Legion Post 366. Memorials in his name may be directed to Trinity Lutheran Church in Loudoun, and Chapman Funeral Home is assisting the family. And the only other obituary we have here is for Mike Beyer, B-E-Y-E-R, age 55, of Marengo, who passed away this past Wednesday, June 22nd, at Compass Memorial Healthcare. The visitation will be tomorrow, June 26th, between 4 and 7 p.m. at Closter Funeral Home in Marengo. And then the funeral will be on Monday, June 27th, at 10:30 a.m. at the First United Methodist Church. Burial will be in Costa Cemetery in Costa, and the family asks for memorials to be contributed in Mike's name to Essence of Life Hospice in Amana. The family also issues a public thank you to Essence of Life Hospice for the care Mike received, as well as care to his family and friends. The print edition of the Gazette today does not have any prep extended story, but I went to the digital version and I do see one, and then after that I will be giving you quite a few scores courtesy of my sports husband Kelly Neff to bring you up to date on some of the local softball and baseball scores. But we do have one story on the digital edition from KJ Pilcher titled Iowa City High Splits with Western Dubuque in Battle Between Ranked High School Baseball Teams. Dateline Iowa City. First, Western Dubuque provided the balanced offense. Then, Iowa City High responded with solid pitching and a renewed approach at the plate. The result was a doubleheader split between highly ranked and Mississippi Valley Conference Mississippi Division leaders Friday night at Mercer Park. The Bobcats claimed the opener 9-5, and the Little Hawks won the nightcap 6-2. Western Dubuque, at 23-6, 18-4 in the conference, maintained its divisional lead. Western Dubuque coach Casey Bryant said, "We were in first place when we started tonight, and we're still there. We're going to keep trying to stay there as long as we can." The Bobcats never trailed in the opener. They built a 3-0 lead when Tucker Nauman doubled and scored in the second, and Isaac then hit a 2-run single in the third. The Little Hawks tied the game with 3 in the bottom of the third, getting an RBI single from Gable Mitchell and Carter Seaton's steal of home. Western Dubuque pulled away with runs in 3 consecutive innings. Jack Clemens and Colton McElrath opened the fourth with singles. Clemens scored on a wild pitch for a 4-3 edge. McElrath scored on Nauman's single, and Caleb Klein scored his second run on Garrett Kadoff's ground out, doubling up the Little Hawks' output. Klein added a 2-run single in the fifth, plating Goodman and Clemens, who had an RBI single in the sixth. Goodman, Klein, Clemens, and Nauman each scored twice. Clemens and then tallied 2 RBIs to lead the Bobcats. All but one Western Dubuque starter had at least 1 hit. Goodman, Nauman, and Clemens had 2 apiece. "That's what we've been doing all year long," Bryant said about the Bobcats' balance attack. Caleb Klein and Jake Goodman both worked well. Then earned the win, allowing 4 runs on 5 hits through 6 innings of work. Goodman pitched the 7th. City High, with a record of 22-8 and 17-7 in conference, were shorthanded Friday, missing starters John Klosterman, Drew Larson, Gavin Cook, and Ben Cooter for undisclosed reasons. Cade Obermuller started the contest but was replaced earlier in the first. Between games, City High coach Brian Mitchell had a simple message for his team. "We've got some guys that have been through the battles, and maybe some of you haven't been through the battles, but now it's time for you to step up," he said. "It's no different from when you guys train. You all train hard. You all should have confidence in yourself. We have confidence in you. That's why you're out there." Mitchell added, "It's been a challenge for us, but each guy has the ability to do it. From top to bottom in our program, we have players to be able to step up in that situation. That's what our expectation is." In the nightcap, City High freshman Talon Young provided a quality start. The right-hander worked more than 5 innings, surrendering just 2 runs on 6 hits in a game that moved to an adjacent field due to some failed lighting on the varsity diamond. Drew Carlson came in to relieve after the game was moved and restarted. He went 1 2/3 scoreless innings, fanning 4 of 7 batters faced. Mitchell came in for 1, closing the game with a strikeout. The elder Mitchell said, "Obviously, we got a great start from Talon. We just really kept them off balance. Did a nice job. He's a competitor. You had the right mix there in velocities and style. Drew did everything he needed to do, and Gable was a competitor at the end." The Little Hawks took a 2-0 lead with 3 first-inning walks, scoring 1 on an error and receiving an RBI single from Carlson. Seton Mitchell and Alex Knutson had RBIs in a 3-run fourth, and Mitchell drove in Joey Buska for an insurance run in the 6th. "Giving a 2-run head start to a high-caliber team, it's hard to overcome that," Bryant said, "especially when you're not getting timely hits." In other baseball, last night, it was Cedar Rapids Xavier over Dubuque Hempstead 6-3, and then North Lynn topped Centerpoint Urbana 10-5. And now we have quite a bit of softball information here. No stories, but I can give you a lot of scores. As I said, Kelly Neff's provided these to me, and I'm passing them along to you. In the Marshalltown tournament, Davenport Assumption beat Lisbon 7-2, and Lisbon then beat Marshalltown 12-0. Other softball, Fairfield 7, Regina 1. Looks like maybe this was a tournament as well. Then Regina beat Williamsburg 8-3. Carlisle beat Williamsburg 5-4. And Fairfield topped West Branch 6-4. It was Solon over DeWitt Central 5-4. And then Williamsburg took on Dubuque Wallert, winning 10-4. West Liberty shut out Janesville 11-0. Looks like there were some tournaments yesterday. In the Linmar Albernett tournament, in the first round, Centerpoint Urbana beat Northeast 12-2. Dallas Center Grimes then did the same with that same score over Iowa City High. It was Linmar over Mid Prairie 4-1. Muscatine shut out Mount Vernon 2-0. Fort Madison topped Cedar Rapids Xavier 3-1. Pleasant Valley shut out Durant 13-0. And North Scott with a whopping 22-0. In the consolation round, then Iowa City High beat Northeast 13-9. Mount Vernon over Mid Prairie 10-2. Durant 4, Cedar Rapids Xavier 2, and then Albernette beat Waverly Shellrock by 12-6. Now in the quarterfinals, Dallas Center Grimes just beat Centerpoint Urbana 5-3, but it was Muscatine in a pretty decisive win over Linmar 11-4. The rest of that Linmar Albernette tournament is going to be played today. As for where some of these teams are ranked right now, in Class 5A, Waukee Northwest is ranked number 1. Linmar's coming in at 10th and Lisbon at 12th. In Class 4A, ADM is number 1, and at third place we have Clear Creek Amana. In Class 3A, number 1 is held by Mount Vernon, but Williamsburg is at number 3. In Class 2A, Central Springs is at the top. Iowa City Regina comes in 6th place. And then in Class 1A, North Lynn is number 1, and Lisbon comes in at 3rd right now. There is one other sports story here that I'm not sure would be covered in other media, maybe like on television or radio or something. So this is a Hawkeye Downs article. It's called Mitchell and the Machines, and it's written by correspondent Justin Webster, Dateline Cedar Rapids. Most 14-year-olds are preparing for their first year of high school, but soon-to-be freshman Reggie Mitchell is finally old enough to follow in his family's footsteps. He has started racing in the hobby stock division at Hawkeye Downs Speedway and is having a lot of success. He stood 4th in the point standings heading into last night's races with 1 victory and 3 top 5 finishes. Mitchell said, "It's more fun than anything. It's nice to do something other than bowling and playing video games." While many young racers choose to gain seat time in go-karts until they reach the minimum age at their local track to jump into an actual car, Mitchell has focused on bowling and learning the behind-the-scenes side of racing. Mitchell's dad, Mike, said, "When he was just starting to walk around age 1, I was under the car working. I looked up and he was under the car with me." Although Reggie migrated toward racing at an early age, the possibility of his driving career actually started in 2004 when his mother Jody, Lana Mitchell, decided there weren't enough women driving at Hawkeye Downs and joined the modified division. In 2006, Jody was looking for help working on her race car when mutual friends introduced Jody to Mike. A year later, the Mitchells were married, and on December 30, 2007, Reggie arrived. With both parents, an older half-brother, Corey Lana, uncles on both sides, and grandparents who loved and were involved with racing, Reggie soaked up every bit of his surroundings. Last summer, although he was still too young to race weekly, Mitchell was given the opportunity to practice at Hawkeye Downs on Wednesdays, allowing him to add seat time to a brain already full of racing knowledge. Mike said, "This is the first thing he's driven. He doesn't even have a permit yet." While Reggie isn't able to drive to his first day of school at Albernett High School in a couple of months, he was able to notch his first win in just his fifth career start. Mitchell said, "I started on the pole and just tried to hold my line." After leading the first two laps, Reggie relinquished his lead but was able to regain the front spot with four laps to go in the 15-lap feature when Matt Pazelka got sideways. After battling down the front stretch, Mitchell's Monte Carlo passed Pedersalka in turn one. "Oh my God, did I just do that?" said Mitchell while he held on for victory. With emotions overflowing from the entire Mitchell team, Reggie's legs went numb as he attempted to exit his hobby stock. His father had to catch him as he climbed out of the car. Mike said he was shaking with excitement. He didn't know what to do. More support followed from the pits as Reggie's buddy and fellow rookie Beckett Flanagan dropped everything and came sprinting to victory lane to congratulate his friend. Mitchell said, "I think this will make me more confident this season, but I don't think it'll really change any of my goals." Jody said, "We'll make sure that confidence stays in check." From the business section, I don't see a local story, however, there is one that may be of interest to some of our listeners, and it's from Bloomberg News, titled "Inflation Fears Ease Slightly, Survey Says." The University of Michigan's final June reading of longer-term consumer inflation expectations settled back from an initially reported 14-year high, potentially reducing the urgency for steeper Federal Reserve interest rate hikes. Respondents said they expect inflation to rise 3.1% over the next 5 to 10 years, down from a preliminary reading of 3.3%, according to Friday's report. They see prices advancing 5.3% over the next year, matching the initial figure. Joanne Sue, director of the survey, said in a statement, "Overall, the late June reversion in long-run inflation expectations was generated by growth in the share of consumers expecting extremely low inflation in the years ahead. About half of these consumers expressed bleak views about the risks of recession or unemployment during the interviews." The inflation expectations results earlier this month played a key role in the Fed's decision last week to raise interest rates by the most since 1994. Chairman Jerome Powell said the Michigan data, along with other recent inflation metrics, helped steer policymakers toward a 75 basis point hike rather than 50 basis points. At a news conference following the move, Powell said the pickup in expectations was quite eye-catching and emphasized how important it is for the central bank to keep long-term inflation expectations anchored. Still, Powell acknowledged that the preliminary number could be revised. According to the report, consumers still expressed the highest level of uncertainty over long-run inflation since 1991, though respondents were broadly certain about the direction of Fed policy. And Bloomberg also contributed this article titled "Remote Work Could Save $206 Billion for Companies." The rise of remote work could make the Federal Reserve's tasks of taming inflation a bit easier while saving employers more than $200 billion, according to new research. That's because workers are willing to accept smaller pay increases for the convenience of working from home. In turn, that helps moderate business costs and slow what economists call the wage-price spiral, when companies pass higher expenses on to consumers in the form of higher prices. About 4 in 10 companies say they've expanded opportunities to work remotely to lessen pressure on their labor budget over the past year, and a similar number expect to do so over the next 12 months, according to a working paper from the University of Chicago. The authors found it would reduce wage growth by 2 percentage points over 2 years. Writing, "This moderating influence lessens pressures and modestly eases the challenge facing monetary policymakers in their efforts to bring inflation down without stalling the economy." The 2 percentage point labor savings for employers translates to $206 billion, according to a separate analysis conducted by Chicago Booth School's Stephen Davis, one of the co-authors. That's based on the $10.3 trillion in total wages and salaries paid to U.S. employees in 2021, according to figures from the Bureau of Economic Analysis. The authors made clear their analysis is not grounds for complacency about near-term inflation pressures. The analysis could provide some macroeconomic support for remote work advocates, who also cite previous research by Nicholas Bloom, one of the co-authors, and other academics that have found the practice can improve job satisfaction and even lower quit rates without harming productivity. In earlier research, Stanford University's Bloom found U.S. workers would be willing to take a 6% pay cut to work from home 2 to 3 days a week. I don't know how the weather's going to affect all these things to do today, because the majority of them are outdoor festivals, but, you know, you might be able to get between the raindrops. There is one Fairfax USA Day festival. It starts with a 5K run, or started with a 5K run and pancake breakfast. There's going to be a State Historical Society mobile museum, street market. There was a parade at 11:30, food, bingo, and a free kids' carnival from 1 to 9 p.m., so there's still time for that. Evening activities conclude with a fireworks display at dusk near the sports complex on Lynn Street. And that is from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. today at the Fairfax Sports Complex. And there's no cost for that. Now, there is also a Cedar Rapids Freedom Festival parade. It returns to downtown Cedar Rapids, where there'll be candy, friends, and music. Afterwards, you can head to Green Square for Imagination Square. That's starting today at 10 o'clock. From 11 to 2, there'll be hands-on activities, face painting, a bouncy house, and more. Again, that cost is free. More free stuff. Festival Dock Dogs. This Freedom Festival event is a series of competitive dog jumping events, such as Big Air, Extreme Vertical, and Speed Retrieval. That's going to be from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. today at Kingston Stadium. The cost is $5 for a Freedom Festival button, but kids that are 8 and under will get in free. And then, oh my, Trek Fest 37 Festival is in Riverside, the future birthplace of Captain Kirk. For a celebration of all things Star Trek, there will be breakfast, or was, a swap meet. There was a parade at 9, model show and contest, a 1K and 5K race, inflatables, beer tent, food, and music. And that's going to go from, started at 7 a.m. and it goes all the way to midnight tonight. And now, let's see, if you are looking more for an indoor event, Mamma Mia! Is going to be shown at Theater Cedar Rapids, 102 3rd Street Southeast. That's at 7:30 tonight. Tickets are $27 and $60, but it tells the story, in case you haven't known, of a mother, a daughter, 3 possible fathers. It includes ABBA's legendary hits from Super Trooper to Dancing Queen, and tells what they call an infectious feel-good story of a young woman's search for her birth father as she prepares to walk down the aisle. We have time for one more article. This is from the Living section, and it's like a question and answer column, the Savvy Senior column. Adaptive clothing takes the stress out of dressing. Question, what kinds of clothing options are available to mobility-challenged seniors who have a difficult time dressing? The answer says, fortunately, there's a wide variety of special clothing known as adaptive clothing that can help with most dressing challenges. Adaptive clothing is specially designed for people with mobility issues, disabilities, and cognitive cognitive challenges who have a difficult time getting dressed. It incorporates discrete design features to make dressing and undressing easier while still having the outward appearance of typical clothing. Some examples include for those who have Parkinson's or other disabilities that affect dexterity. There are pants, shirts, dresses, and outerwear with Velcro or magnetic closures instead of buttons and zippers, which are much easier to fasten and unfasten. But for those with pacemakers, these kinds of magnetic closures are not suitable. For those who are disabled or have a limited range of motion and need assistance dressing, there are adaptive pants with zippers or snaps on both sides that are easier to pull on, and a wide range of rear closure shirts, tops, and dresses with Velcro or snap fasteners in the back for those who can't raise their arms over their head. For wheelchair users, there are higher back and elastic waistband pants that don't slip down, as well as pants with fabric overlaps at the seat to allow for easier toileting access. For people with tactile sensitivity, there are garments that have soft and stretchy fabrics without tags and are sewn with flat seams to prevent chafing. For seniors with Alzheimer's disease, there are one-piece jumpsuits with a back zipper access to prevent the wearer from disrobing inappropriately. They provide a long list of places, but they say that mainstream clothing stores like JCPenney, Target, and Tommy Hilfiger have started offering adaptive clothing for adults, and then they recommend going to the website, but you might be able to find out more through perhaps research or other friends as well. You can also find a large selection at online stores that specialize in adaptive clothing. Some of those are Buck and Buck. com and Silverts, S-I-L-V as in Victor, E-R-T-S.com. They've been selling adaptive clothing for decades and offer a wide variety to meet many needs. You can also check out Joe and Bella, B-E-L-L-A.com, Ovidus.com, and IZAdaptive.com, which sells clothing primarily for wheelchair users. Adaptive shoes can be found at places like Kizik, K-I-Z-I-K.com, and Zeba, Z-E-B-A, shoes.com. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Saturday, June 25th. I've been your reader, Mary Neff. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thank you for listening.